This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Last theory event of the year, at least before the fall, and I'll just say a few words about Catherine Liu and Charlie Shepherdson, who are here tonight with us, to animate and discuss and present Lacan's television. I will not read the bibliographies. You have them in the handouts that are on the podium. I'll just add that Catherine Liu, on top of her book Copying Machines, is also the author of a novel, Oriental Girls Desire Romance, and that Charles Shepherdson has published two books and many, many articles. But I'll just say that perhaps what connects us four with Aaron tonight is that we all participated in the Cambridge Companion to Lacan, Catherine and Charles by writing excellent articles, contributions to it. I edited the volume, and Aaron the illustration for the cover. So it's with this collective work behind us that we want to address the difficult issue of how to present to an American audience this little book that is called Television, based on the broadcast, the only broadcast Jacques Lacan allowed to be made, and that he officially wrote and masterminded. And we've decided not to read the whole translation, but to select three chapters out of eight, making a break after chapter one and three. Then we'll have a short discussion. Then we'll read or veil, impersonate Lacan and Jacques-Alain Miller asking questions for chapter five. And then we read something that gives more meaning to the political context, which is the Impromptu de Vincennes, the Vincennes Impromptu, that has to do with Lacan's political role after May 68. And finally, we'll show a few clips from Chris Marker's documentaries of the time.
Green without a cat. I always speak the truth, not the whole truth, because there's no way to say
pas
it all.
Toute. Parce que toute la dire, on
saying
y
it all is literally impossible. Words fail.
C'est
yet it's through this very impossibility
matériellement
that the truth holds on to the real. I will confess then to having tried to respond to the present comedy, and it was only good for the wastebasket. A failure then, but thereby actually a success when compared with an error, or to put it better, with an aberration. And without too much importance, since limited to this occasion, but first of all, which? The aberration consists in this idea of speaking so as to be understood by idiots. An idea that is ordinarily foreign to me, that it could only have been suggested to me through friendship. Beware. For there's no difference between television and the public before whom I've spoken for a long time now, a public known as my seminar, a single gaze in both cases, a gaze to which in neither case do I address myself, but in the name of which I speak. Do not, however, get the idea that I address everyone at large. I am speaking to those who are savvy, to the non-idiots, to the supposed analysts. If we consider only the overcrowding Experience shows that what I say there engages many more people than those whom, with some reason, I suppose to be analysts. So why, then, should I use a different tone here than for my seminar? Besides, I may reasonably suppose there to be analysts listening now also.
Même à s'en tenir,
I will go further. I expect of the supposed analysts nothing more than their being this object, thanks to which I teach, is not a self-analysis. On this point, they alone, among those who are listening, are sure to understand me. But even in understanding nothing, an analyst plays this role I have just defined. And as a consequence, television thus assumes it just as well. I would add that these analysts were such only insofar as they are object, the object of the analysand. It happens that I do address them, not that I am speaking to them, but that I speak about them, if only to disturb them. Who knows? This could have some effects of suggestion. Would you believe it? There is one situation in which suggestion is powerless, when the analyst owes his default to the other, to the person who has brought him to the pass, as I put it, of asserting himself as analyst. Happy are those cases in which fictive passes pass for an incomplete training. They leave room for hope.
The psychologists, the psychotherapists, the psychiatrists, all the mental health workers. It's the rank and file, those who are roughing it, who are taking all the burdens of the world's misery onto their shoulders. And the analyst, meanwhile?
Unconscious.
All raw. Very raw. Completely raw. Raw. By way of a parenthesis here, does the unconscious imply that it be listened to? To my mind, yes. But this surely does not imply that without the discourse through which it exists, one judges it as knowledge that does not think or calculate or judge, which doesn't prevent it from being at work, as in dreams, for example. Let's say that it is the ideal worker, the one Marx made the flower of capitalist economy, in the hope of seeing him take over the discourse of the master, which, in effect, is what happened, although in an unexpected form. There are surprises in these matters of discourse, that is, indeed, the point of the unconscious. What I call the analytic discourse is the social bond determined by the practice of an analyst. It derives its value from its being placed amongst the most fundamental of the bonds which remain viable for us. But you yourself
are excluded from that which makes for social bonds between analysts, aren't you?
The association, so-called international, although this is a bit of a fiction, having been for so long now limited to a family business, I still knew it in the hands of Freud's direct and adopted descendants. If I dared, but I warn you that here I am both judge and plaintiff, hence partisan, I would say that at present it is a professional insurance plan against analytic discourse. The Peapod. Damned Peapod. They want to know nothing of the discourse that determines them, but they are not thereby excluded from it. Far from it, since they function as analysts, which means that there are people who analyze themselves by means of them. So they satisfy this discourse, even if some of its effects go unrecognized by them. On the whole, they don't lack prudence, and even if it isn't the true kind, it might be the do-good kind. Besides, they are the one at risk. So let's turn to the psychoanalysts and not beat about the bush. Though what I am going to say is to be found under the bush as well, because there is no better way of placing him objectively than in relation to what was in the past called being a saint. During his lifetime, a saint doesn't command the respect that a halo sometimes gets for him. No one notices him as he follows Baltasar Gracián's way of life, that of renouncing personal brilliance, something that explains why Amelot de la Houssaye thought he was writing about the courtier. A saint's business, to put it clearly, is not caritas. Rather, he acts as trash, his business being trashitas. So as to embody what the structure entails, namely allowing the subject of the unconscious, to take him as the cause of the subject's own desire. In fact, it is through the abjection of this cause that the subject in question has a chance to be aware of his position, at least within the structure. To the saint, this is not amusing. But I imagine that for a few years glued to this TV, it converges with many of the oddities of the acts of saints. That it produces an effect of jouissance. Who doesn't get the meaning, sens, along with the pleasure, joui? The saint alone stays silent, stays mum, says here. Fat chance of getting anything out of him. That is really the most amazing thing in the whole business. Amazing for those who approach it without illusions. The saint is the refuse of jouissance. Sometimes, however, he takes a break, which he's no more content than anyone else. He comes, il jouit. He's no longer working at that point. It's not as if the smart alecs aren't lying in wait, hoping to profit from it so as to pump themselves up again. But the saint doesn't give a damn about that any more than he does about those who consider it to be his just deserts, which is two sides splitting, because not giving a damn for distributive justice either is where he most often started from. The saint doesn't really see himself as righteous, which doesn't mean that he has no ethics. The only problem for others is that you can't see where it leads him. I beat my brain against the hope that some like these will reappear, no doubt because I myself didn't manage to make it. The more saints, the more laughter. That's my principle, to wit, the way out of capitalist discourse, which will not constitute progress if it only happens for some.
Dans l'ensemble, la prudence ne leur manque pas. Et même si ce n'est pas la vraie.
We couldn't sync it up because actually there were differences between what was being said and the English transcription. Not only that, but we also just couldn't imitate his cadences. And it wasn't a mimetic intention here. So we're going to take a break, and Jean-Michel is going to start a discussion.
I'll just say a few things about the context of this film. It's relatively unexpected and astonishing even that Lacan accepted this invitation to be on French television. Let's not forget that France at that time was not a heavily mediatized society, and that even if De Gaulle and Pompidou would use television, it was with this kind of very static framework. In 1973, Lacan was 72, and one can see his age, but at the same time, he was a celebrity. His seminar had been forced to move from the École Normale Supérieure in the spring of 69 to go to two sites that were enormous. He had something like thousands of people, literally, listening to Lacan, who would always speak like this, that is, with a mixture of very crude, funny, bawdy jokes that are hard to translate, and his own vocabulary. Jouissance is a new term, and so on, and a few other terms appear. There's something paradoxical, and I think it explains this arrogant...
Excuse me. Turn off that mic. Sorry.
This is a symptom.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
When he talks about idiots, this is the first thing I'd like to comment upon. It was obvious that Lacan seminar, as he says, that was originally aimed at the formation of psychoanalysts, had become a Parisian venue. something to which, you know, tourists or students who just come like that, and of course not understand a word. And in that sense, what he's saying is that there is not such a difference between what his seminar has turned into, and Catherine has done a very brilliant analysis, maybe she wants to talk about this later, comparing Lacan to Andy Warhol, and the way both used and exploited the media and the image that they were projecting for an audience that could not understand, simply, as simple as that. Nevertheless, what Lacan is trying to convey is that, in spite of that, insofar as you allow him to talk and to use the media, to use the radio, to use radiophonie, and to use television, something can be conveyed. Nothing will ever be lost. And this is why he begins with this startling assertion, I always speak the truth, but not all the truth. And this is something that he, I think, stages in his own discourse. That's one very, very brief contextualization. The other point I'd like to make very briefly, and in my own account of my encounter with Lacan and by having been in his seminar, there was always this impression, I think, all those who could listen to his voice were struck by a very particular style and tone, which is hard to render, with a sort of Parisian why, we would say, like the E's are always elided, which is normally like low speech, and the rhythm, and you can see this a little bit in the gestuality, is a little curious and therefore complex, difficult to make sense of. In fact, what had taken place, and that's why I stressed the age, was that in a sense Lacan had tried to be or to become attuned to the young generation that had emerged with the anti-Vietnam protests and the 68 moment in France. And it's clear that he's actually talking to them, not so much to the analysts or to the public at large, but to students who were between 18 and 25. And
that's his relationship to youth culture is really interesting here, precisely because of his own, you know, very, very fractious relations with the International Psychoanalytical Association, which he calls, which is translated in the English as PPOT, but professional insurance against, you know, psychoanalytic discourse or something like that. But in French, it's SAMSTA, which sounds like SAMISDAT. And, you know, in a move very similar to Mao's move, he spoke above the heads of the bureaucrats and the technocrats directly to the discontentment of students. And that's why his son-in-law, who staged something, Jacques-Alain Miller, I think, could understand this and responded to him. He was an École Normalien, who was part of a Maoist groupuscule, a small group, along with Jacques Ancière and
Badiou.
That's right, and Alain Badiou.
And
they were in philosophy. They were self-declared Maoists. And Miller married his daughter and became, and is still today, the sort of baron and the executor of the will.
Right.
So,
and what's important in the way he uses his own vocabulary is to see how many terms are borrowed from Marx. So one might say that this is a Freudo-Marxist moment for Lacan, trying to. This was due partly to his friendship with Althusser and all the students who were becoming the members, the active members of his school, had been trained by Althusser as Marxist epistemologists. But in Lacan's own discourse, this reference to Marx is extremely systematic even though he's not a Marxist, as he says, a critical fellow traveler, one might say.
But what brings together Charlie's work on affect in Lacan and Jean-Michel's work on hysteria is that I think what Lacan does is he hystericizes Marxist discourse, where he brings out that which is hysterical in the demand of the militant.
Yes, and this is why we'll end up by this Vincennes discussion, because one can see how Lacan is in a way conflating several discursive spaces. First, the seminar in which he would train psychoanalysts, then this space of public discourse, Lacan becoming like a public intellectual, as it were, and then the space of the leftist agitation with the students and the workers on strike and so on.
So, shall we go on to section 5?
You have a question.
Hmm?
You have a question.
Oh, I'll do the question. Okay. There's a rumor afoot. If we had such bad sex, it's because sex is suppressed, and that's the fault, in the first place, of the family, and in the second, of society, and equally of capitalism. This requires an answer.
That's the question. I've been told when chatting about your questions, it might well be understood as being about your wanting to be able to answer it yourself, eventually. That is, if you were asked it by a voice rather than by an individual, a voice inconceivable except as arising from the TV, a voice that doesn't exist because it doesn't say anything, the voice, nonetheless, in the name of which I make this answer, exists, an answer that is interpretation. To put it bluntly, you know that I've got an answer to everything, in consideration of which you credit me with the question. You place your faith in the proverb that one lend only to the rich, and with good reason. Who doesn't know that it's with the analytic discourse that I've made it big? That makes me a self-made man. There have been others, but not in our lifetime. Freud didn't say that repression comes from suppression, that, to paint a picture, castration is due to what daddy brandished over his brat playing with his wee-wee. We'll cut it off, no kidding, if you do it again. Naturally enough, however, it occurred to him, to Freud, to start with that for the experiment, as understood through the terms of definition of analytic discourse. Let's say that as he progressed there, he leaned more toward the idea that repression was primary, that on the whole, what tipped the scales toward the second topography. The greediness by which he characterizes the superego is structural, not an effect of civilization, but discontent, symptom in civilization. So that's why we have to re-examine the test case, taking as a starting point the fact that it is repression that produces suppression. Why couldn't the family, society itself, be creations built from repression? They're nothing less. That, however, may be because the unconscious exists, is motivated by structure, that is, by language. Freud is so far from excluding this solution that it's in order to come to some decision on it that he works so hard in the case of the Wolfman, a man who ends up in rather bad shape. Still, it would seem that this failure of the case, is relatively unimportant when compared with his success, that of establishing the real within the facts. If this real remains enigmatic, must we attribute this to the analytic discourse, itself an institution? To get to the bottom of sexuality, we have no recourse other than the project of science, sexology still being only a project in which Freud, as Freud insists, he has every confidence. A confidence that he admits is gratuitous, which says a lot about his ethics. Now, this analytic discourse implies a promise to promote a novelty, and that, awesomely enough, into the field from which the unconscious is produced, since its fineness is, among other situations to be sure, but it is still the main one, come into play in the game of love. Not that everyone isn't alerted to this novelty that is the talk of the town, but it doesn't rouse everybody for the reason that this novelty is transcendental. The word is to be taken up under the same sign that it constitutes for the theory of numbers, namely mathematically. It is not without reason, then, that it takes support in the name of transference. In order to rouse people around me, I articulate this transference with the subject supposed to know. This contains an explication, an unfolding, of what the name only dimly pins down, namely, that through the transference, the subject is attributed to the knowledge that gives him his consistency as subject of the unconscious. And it is that which is transferred onto the analyst, namely, this knowledge, inasmuch as it does not think, or calculate, or judge, but carries with it, nonetheless, the work effect. This new path is worth whatever it's worth, but it's as if I were whistling in the... No, worse. It's as if I were scaring them out of their wits. Sancta pipidas simplicitas. They don't dare. They dare not follow where that leads. It's not as if I don't turn myself inside out. I declaim, no one authorizes the analyst but himself. I institute the pass in my école, namely the examination of what decides an analyst to assert himself as analyst, forcing no one through it. It hasn't been heard outside yet, I admit, but here inside we're busy with it. And as for my école, I haven't had it that long. It's not that I'm hoping that outside of here, the transference will cease being viewed as a return to sender. That is the attribute of the patient, a singularity that touches us only in that it demands our prudence in evaluating it. First, even more than in handling it. In the former, we can adjust to it, but in the latter, who knows where we'd be going. What I do know is that the analytic discourse cannot be sustained by one person only. It's my good fortune to have followers. Thus, the discourse has a chance. No amount of excitement, which it stirs up as well, can lift away the evidence of a curse on sex, which Freud evokes in his discontents. If I've talked of annoyance, of moroseness, in connection with the divine approach of love, how can one not recognize that these two affects are betrayed through speech, even indeed, in those young people dedicated to relations without repression? The most extraordinary thing being that the analysts with whom they claim as their impetus stare back at them tight-lipped. Even if the memories of familial suppression weren't true, they would have to be invented, and that is certainly done. That's what myth is, the attempt to give an epic form to what is operative through the structure. The sexual impasse exudes the fictions that rationalize the impossible within which it originates. I don't say they are imagined. Like Freud, I read in them the invitation to the real that underwrites them. The familial order is nothing but the translation of the fact that the father is not the progenitor, and that the mother remains the contaminator of woman for man's offspring. The remainder follows from that. It's not that I value the craving for order we find in this offspring, expressed when he says, personally, sick, I loathe anarchy. The definition of order, as soon as there is the least little bit, is that you don't have to crave it, since there it is, established. The fact that it already happened somewhere in our good fortune, a fortune good for nothing more than demonstrating that things are going badly there for liberty, even in its sketchiest form. That's simply capitalism set straight. Back to zero, then, for the issue of sex. Since anyway, capitalism, that was its starting point, getting rid of sex, you've given in to leftism, but not, so far as I know, to sexo-leftism. That's because the latter relies solely on analytic discourse, such as it exists at the moment. It exists badly, managing simply to redouble the curse on sex, in which it shows itself to be in dread of this ethic that I located in being well-spoken.
Isn't that just the recognition that one must expect nothing from psychoanalysis, so far learning as how to make love go? So that, understandably, hopes are directed towards sexology.
As I've just suggested, it is actually sexology that you can't expect anything from. There is no way, on the basis of observing just what crosses our senses, namely perversion, that anything new in love will ever be constructed. God, however, has existed so well that paganism has peopled the world with him without anyone's being aware of what it was about. That's what we're coming back to. Thank God, as we say, other traditions allow us to believe that there have been more sensible people. In Tao, for example, it is a pity that what was meaningful for them is without impact for us, leaving our jouissance cold. There's nothing surprising in that if the way, as I've said, passes through the sign. If some finesse, impasse, can be demonstrated along the way, and I mean asserted through this demonstration, there lies a chance for us to be in touch with the real, pure, and simple, as that which prevents one from saying the whole truth about it. There will be no erotheism, dehors de l'amour, until this score is settled, the complex term of which can only be uttered after being twisted.
You don't oppose the young, tight-lipped, as you put it, certainly not since you fired on them one day at Vincennes with what you revolutionaries aspire to as a master. You will have one. Frankly, you are discouraging the young.
They got on my back, which was the fashion at the time. I had to take a stand. A stand whose truth was so clear that they've been crowding into my seminar ever since, preferring my cool, after all, to the crack of the whip.
From another direction, what gives you the confidence to prophesy the rise of racism? And why the devil do you have to speak of it?
Because it doesn't strike me as funny, and yet it's true. With our jouissance going off the track, only the other is able to mark its position. But only insofar as we are separated from this other, whence certain fantasies, unheard of before the melting pot. Leaving this other to his own mode of jouissance, that would only be possible by not imposing our own on him, by not thinking of him as underdeveloped. Given too the precariousness of our own mode, which from now on takes its bearings from the ideal of an overcoming, plus de jouir, which is in fact no longer expressed in any other way, how can one hope that the empty forms of humanitarianism, disguising our exhortations, can continue to last? Even if God, thus newly strengthened, should end up existing, this bodes nothing better than a return of his baneful past.
What I wanted to do here was to show you a few of the May 68 posters that were made around the protest of the French National Radio and Television Federation. And I should say that the journalists of both radio and television went on strike in sympathy with the students after the first 13 days, when it became apparent to them that the government was going to suppress the student protest violently. But one of the things that I wanted to do also is to, because we ended on this, is to talk a little bit about, and I hope we'll discuss this more today, about how Lacan in 1971, 72, 73, the time of the television seminars, was already predicting the rise of the right at a moment when the anti-Vietnam movement had produced a kind of consensus among the new left of the industrialized world that racism was bad, that colonialism was bad, and that the youth movement was characterized by this impetus to destroy the prejudices of the father, of the parents. Now, should we have the first slide? These were lithographs made, and they were anonymous, and they were displayed around the streets of Paris for the entire month of May. Basically, what happened was that the École des Beaux-Arts, fine arts students, took over the lithography studios and began to produce posters that were highly polemical. And one of these posters is this one is the ORTF in struggle, independence for an independent media. These were state-sponsored. The radio and television stations were all state-sponsored. And so liberating media was something that 1968 represented for the student movement, trying to find a more authentic discourse that that could be public was one of the demands of the students. And I'm only going to show you a few of these. This one is, attention, the radio is lying. And I think it's an interesting riposte in a way. What Lacan does on television is then respond to the exhausted, disillusioned student activists in 1972, because 69 was the year of street fighting when the student movement was actually suppressed by the government. And he's offering them, I think, this idea that an analytic discourse, the cool, what he calls the cool of analytic discourse, will be a more authentic language, more authentic than the orthodox communists of the Communist Party, more authentic than, of course, the right-wing pablum that fills the airwaves. And so Lacan's seizure of the airwaves, because at around the same time he also makes radio broadcast, whose transcript we have now called Radiophonie, is also are interesting acts. Now, what's funny about the Lacan tape, and not funny, but ironic about the Lacan tape, and why it's interesting that we get to see it today in this form, is that there's no authorized subtitled version of it in English. It was shown once in 1987. Jacques Alain Miller, the son-in-law, brought it in. So in this public broadcast in 1973, Lacan wants to reach the largest audience possible. Suddenly, this tape goes into the archives of the Lacan family legacy, and we show it today without permission because we're doing it in a sort of collage effect. And I think one of the ways in which we're also trying to highlight the mediaticity or Lacan's own media savviness is, I think, by giving you a thicker context, if you like. So here's another one of the École des Beaux-Arts posters. La police à l'ORTF, c'est la police chez vous. So that means, you know, when you turn on the television and you turn on the radio, what you hear is actually the police in your home. That what you have is this enormously censored, enormously impoverished language of media, and breaking through that means, you know, joining the student movements, militating, becoming militant. And one of the reasons why Miller was able to get Lacan on television was that in the massive chaos and disorganization of the ORTF, the journalists themselves, as I said, who sympathized with the students, wanted a massive reorganization of their own organizations, of their own structures. And so there was an opening in the early 70s. But what does Lacan do when he gets this opening? He actually predicts the rise of racism, the rise of the right. And this is why I wanted to show clips from an also difficult to see film by Chris Marker, which is a 20-year meditation on student movement and the decline of the left and the rise of the right. And I'll just introduce these clips from Chris Marker's Grin Without a Cat by saying that what I think Lacanian theory allows us to theorize is the two faces of the right. As we see them in France and the United States today, we can see them both. There's the obscene face of the right that harkens back to the primal father that says, enjoy attacking the other, enjoy sadism, and transgresses with you, winks. You know, it's the wink to the sadistic relation with the other. And this liberational, transgressive thunder that was the left's revolutionary fervor has been stolen by the right and transformed into this obscene permissiveness with regard to the other. What the left has then is the prohibitive, superegoic injunction, no, you shall not treat the other in this way. And Lacan makes fun of this, the rise of the humanitarianism as a function of, he puns on humanitarianism, of course, as a function of the left's do-goodism. Psychoanalysis is neither, you know, left nor right in a way, and this is what was, I think, so strangely powerful about it in the early 70s and continues to be for me now. But the other side of the right that Lacan doesn't so much address, but that Marker shows, is this rise of suddenly the modern man of the right, who's embodied by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. No longer is the right in France in the 70s embodied by the old fuddy-duddies like Pompidou and de Gaulle, you know, father figures who are not savvy about consumer culture, who are, you know, totemic in their immovability. We suddenly have this rise, and Marker catches him playing the accordion well before Bill Clinton plays the saxophone and David Letterman, showing his weaknesses, but showing his modernness. So you have a modern right, the face of the modern man of the right, and the underbelly of the right that the modern face winks at, which is the racist, transgressive, obscene, jouissif face of the right. And what Marker concludes his film with, which I think is a very ambiguous figure, is the leftist, the militant, as an endangered species. And throughout this film, the leftist has been identified with the animal. And I'll just leave it at that. Let's show the clips now. This is from Chris Marker's Grin Without a Cat, made from 1971. This is at an anti-war demonstration at Columbia where half the students are burning their draft cards and the other half are heckling them.
Hey, bomb Hanoi! Bomb Hanoi! Bomb Hanoi!
Get me the known smile. And they're holding up their draft cards, ready to go.
That's good, Vietnam was and still is.
It's what was to be known as the new left. Perhaps what people noticed less at the time was the emergence of the new right.
His most charismatic leader was Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. Minister of Finance for quite a few years, he put a lot of energy into projecting an image that was sporting, young, and up to date.
At that time, we were inclined to think that the strategies were rather poor. Today, looking back, we see that they were.
The bet was lost, for politics were changing faster than the music.
So our editor would marvel at the ingenuity of history, which always seems to have more imagination than we do. He would remember the end of the film as he completed it in 1977, comparing the arms trafficking of the great powers with the process of culling as practiced by remote control technicians trying to keep the wolf population down to a manageable level. But guess whom they arm now? A comforting thought, however. 15 years later, some wolves still survive.
Say one little thing, adding to Catherine's commentary. It's amazing to see Lacan in the 70s foretelling, predicting the joint rise of racism and religious fundamentalism, because this was really
anti-humanitarianism.
Yeah, and you know, this new God that is coming back, that he sees as part of the right. And at the same time, without any illusion as to what he calls humanitaire, it's not so well translated into English. Humanitarerie has nothing to do with hysteria, as they translate it. But, you know, humanitarian movements. And indeed, somehow, this has marked, I would say, the last decade of the last century, somehow, at least in France and Europe, the left went into the discourse of ethics and humanitarian action and so on. And Lacan has no, say, patience with that. It's just a sort of ideological cover to mask this unleashing of jouissance that he sees in racism, in the return of the right, and in, I mean, to quote a very recent text by Slavoj Žižek, I don't know whether you saw it, but I think it demonstrates that the concepts that Lacan invented around that time are still very relevant, I would say. There's in the latest issue of the London Review of Books, you may have seen this, Žižek describes, you know, the torture, why can American soldiers torture prisoners? And he says that it is indeed a different kind. It would be absurd to say that they just follow in the steps of the sadism of Saddam Hussein's guards. But what we see is precisely something that has to do with sexual humiliation and the obscene enjoyment of playing with the other and degrading the other.
So as our final reading, before we open it up to questions for you, Charlie will make a presentation before we open up to questions, we'd like to read part of that Un Pompier à Vincennes, which is a transcript of student confrontations with Lacan during the seminars that he was giving in Vincennes in 1969. And you have to recall that there were armed militia at this point, students fighting the police, and many of Lacan's peers, like Lévi-Strauss, were completely dejected. The generation of the professors of the mandarins at that time, others were in retreat, felt embattled, felt as if they had been what they were working for had been destroyed within the university. And Lacan is there on the front line, sort of giving his seminar and sort of taking the shit, as it were. And in a sense, listening to them. And I think what I hope we can convey to you is a bit also of his disarray before the angry demands of the student militants. Lacan, stop making fun of people, okay?
So where
are you? Oh, sorry, it's page 122. Jean-Michel is going to read Lacan.
122. Okay.
In the middle.
Okay. Jacques Lacan.
Okay. Oh, Lacan, stop making fun of people, okay?
You bring to bear a discourse with such demands.
For my part, what I propose is that people not be made fun of when they ask a question. One doesn't adopt a high-pitched voice, as you just did on these three occasions. One answers, and that's it. So then, what was the question you asked? And then there's something else. Since some people here think that psychoanalysis is about getting enough ass, All we have to do on stage is a love-in. Anyone want to turn this into a wild love-in?
Beginning to undress, he stopped after taking off his shirt.
Listen, my friend, I already saw that last night. I was at the Open Theater. There's a guy who did that. But he had a little more nerve than you. He stripped till he was completely naked. Go ahead. I mean, why don't you continue? Shit.
All the same, let's not kid ourselves. Why is Lacan satisfied with so limited a criticism of this comrade's practice? To bang on the table and save the comrade that he can't undress may be very funny, but it's also very simplistic.
Well, I am simplistic.
And that makes them laugh. It's interesting.
But I don't see... Sorry.
I don't see why all of a sudden they wouldn't laugh.
As for me, I'd like them to laugh at that moment.
This is sad.
Just as it's sad to see people coming out of here as though out of a subway at 6 p.m.
So where are we now? It appears that people can't talk about psychoanalysis because they're waiting for me to be the one to do it. Well, let me tell you, they're right, because I can do it much better than they can.
That's not exactly it, since they feel the need to speak among themselves.
That's been demonstrated.
There are a certain number of individuals, the same ones who are taking notes and laughing, who, whenever Lacan gets hold of his audience, tell each other a certain number of things without rising from their seats. And what's at stake here is a certain topology. Well, those are the people I'd like to hear.
Come on, let Lacan speak.
In the meanwhile, you're not saying a thing.
L-A-C-A-N with us.
I am with you. Well, the hour is getting late. Let's try, nevertheless, to give you some idea of what I'm trying to do. It is a matter of articulating a logic, which, however feeble it may appear to be, my four little letters that don't look like anything except that the rules according to which they function must be known, is still strong enough to include the sign of that logical strength, to wit, incompleteness. Ha ha ha. It makes them laugh, except that it has a very important consequence, particularly for revolutionaries, which is that no thing is all.
Oh, fine.
From whatever angle you take things, and however you may turn them, the property of each of these four-legged little diagrams, and he's talking about the four discourses, is to allow each its cleft. At the level of the discourse of the master, it's precisely that of the retrieval of surplus value. At the level of academic discourse, it's another one. And that's the one that torments you. Not that the knowledge is transmitted to you is not structured and solid, and you have but one thing to do, which is to weave yourself in with those who are working, that is, those who are teaching you as means of production and as a result of surplus value. At the level of the discourse of the hysteric, which is the one that enabled a decisive transition by giving its meaning to what Marx articulated historically, namely, that there are historical events that can be judged only in terms of symptoms. No one saw how far that went until the day there appeared the discourse of the hysteric in order to effect the transition to something else, which is the discourse of the psychoanalyst. The psychoanalyst at first had but to listen to the discourse of the hysteric.
Consequently, the hysteric is the master of the psychoanalyst.
I want a man who knows how to make love. Well, indeed, that's where man stops. He stops in that he is indeed someone who knows. As for making love, we'll get back to you later on that. No thing is all, and you can always indulge in your little jokes, but there is one that is not funny, and it's castration.
While this lecture is droning on peacefully, there are 150 comrades from Beaux-Arts who have been arrested by the cops and who have been at Beaujon since yesterday because they don't teach courses about the objet quotidien like the Mandarin in our presence, about whom nobody gives a damn. They went to teach at a wildcat seminar at the Ministry of Equipment on the subject of slums and the policies of Monsieur Chalandon. So I think that the drone of this magisterial lecture conveys rather well the present state of decay of the university.
Because frankly, everything that he says is bullshit, no?
You bet.
If nobody wants to let me speak plainly, it's because nobody knows just how loud I can yell. Lacan, I'd like to tell you some things. It seems to me that we have to come to the point where it is clear that some form of contestation can possibly take shape in this auditorium. It is clear that we can sound a few shrill cries, make a few good puns, but it is also clear, and perhaps quite evidently so today, that we can never arrive at a critique of the university if we remain within it, within its courses, and within the rules that it established prior to our intervention. I think that what the comrade just said about the Beaux-Arts students who went to teach a Wildcat seminar on the subject of slums and Chalandon's policies outside of the university is a very important example. It allows us to find an outlet for our will to change society and, among other things, to destroy the university. And I would like Lacan to give us his opinion on that in a little while. For the university will not be destroyed by a majority of students working within it, but more likely on the basis of a union that we students should forge on revolutionary grounds with the workers and the peasants. I am well aware that no relation exists between this and what Lacan was just saying.
But not at all, not at all. It does exist.
It may perhaps exist, but not in any clear fashion. The relation between the actions we ought to take on the outside and Lacan's discourse, if that's what it is manifestly implicit. It would be good if Lacan told us now what he thinks of the necessity of stepping out of the university and stop screwing around with words, challenging some professor about one quotation or another from Marx. Because we've had it up to here with this academic Marxism. We've been hearing people drool over the subject on this campus for a year now, and we know it's shit. To do academic Marxism is to serve the bourgeois university. If we are to overthrow the university, it will be from the outside with others who are on the outside.
So why are you inside?
I am inside, comrade, because if I want people to leave, I have to come in and tell them.
Ah, you see, everything is there, my friend. You know that then, to get them to go out, you come in.
Lacan, let me finish. Everything is not there, because certain students still think that by listening to the discourse of Monsieur Lacan, they will find in it the elements that will allow them to contest his discourse. I say that they're letting themselves be had.
Quite right.
If we think it's by listening to the discourse of Lacan, Foucault, Dumergue, Terray, or anyone else that we'll be able to criticize the ideology that they're making us swallow, we're looking up our own asses. I say that we have to look outside for the means to overthrow the university.
I didn't say that. Knowledge was king. I didn't say that. No?
So?
And so, that has certain consequences. That is, my dear fellow, you would not be very comfortable here.
We asked a question concerning one society, and you answer about another society. What you have to say is why you think it's inevitable.
I quite agree. For there are limits that shouldn't be transgressed in a certain logic, which I've called feeble, although it's still strong enough to allow you a bit of incompletion, to which you're attesting quite perfectly.
As for me, I wonder why this amphitheater is jammed with 800 people. It's true that you are a fine and famous clown, and you have come to speak. A comrade also spoke for 10 minutes in order to say that militant groups couldn't work their own way out of the university. And everyone recognizing that there's nothing to be said speaks in order to say nothing. Well, if there is nothing to be said, nothing to understand, nothing to know, nothing to do, why is there this crowd then? And why, Lacan, are you staying here?
We are a bit lost here amidst a false problem. And all because the comrade said that he came to the university in order to leave again with other comrades.
There's talk of a new society. Will psychoanalysis play a role in that society, and what will it be?
A society is not something that can be defined just like that. What I am attempting to articulate, because analysis gives me the evidence, is what dominates it, to wit, the practice of language. Aphasia means that there is something that has broken down in that area. Imagine there are guys to whom stuff happens in their brain and who can no longer in any way manage to make do with language. It leaves them rather infirm.
One could say that Lenin almost became an aphasic.
If you had a little patience, and if you were willing for our impromptu to continue, I would tell you that the aspiration to revolution has but one conceivable issue always, the discourse of the master. That is what experience has proved. What you, as revolutionaries, aspire to is a master. You will have one.
We already have him. We've got Pompidou.
You actually think you have a master with Pompidou? Well, but what are you talking about? I, too, would like to ask some questions. For whom here does the word liberal have a meaning?
Pompidou is a liberal, Lacan too.
I am liberal, like everyone else, only insofar as I am anti-progressive. with a single modification, I'm caught in a movement which deserves to be called progressive, for it is progressive to see the discourse of psychoanalysis achieve its foundation insofar as it completes the circle that might perhaps allow you to situate what precisely is at stake, what it is that you are rebelling against, which will not at all prevent it from continuing smashingly well. And the first to collaborate with it, and right here at Vincennes, are you, for you fulfill the role of the healers of this regime. You don't know what that means either? The regime puts you on display. It says, watch them fuck. Well, there it is. So long for today. Bye. It's over. We can open the discussion, maybe. Questions?
Well, I was thinking about starting off a little bit by just sort of elaborating a few remarks that Catherine and I were talking about on our way up here in the car from the city, and she was talking about these films, these clips that we just saw, and the rise of the right and its connection with religion and with the things that Lacan says about God, and I was also struck by the mention of things that are not really technical terms in Lacan's discourse, but just at the end of the last section of Television that we were reading in section 5, you remember the remarks, it's on page 30, near the top, where Lacan says, speaking of civilization and its discontents, he says, if I've talked of annoyance, of moroseness, in connection with the divine approach of love, how can one not recognize that these two affects are betrayed in those young people dedicated to relations without repression, and so on and so on. And it struck me that this reference to annoyance or moroseness or affect or emotion or mood in some way maybe connects in terms of Lacan's predicting far ahead of others the rise of the right and of the kind of jouissance that we saw on the face of the Columbia students who are chanting "Bomb Hanoi, Bomb Hanoi," that kind of fascinating non-discursive kind of satisfaction that they were showing. While on the other hand, the liberal community now so much is caught up with talking about melancholia, suddenly, not just mourning really, but melancholia. And Lacan here speaks of moroseness or annoyance. And then 2 pages later, on page 32, he says at the bottom of the page, in the last 3 paragraphs, he says, with our jouissance going off the track, only the other is able to mark its position, but only insofar as we are separated from this other. I was thinking about that sentence, and so I thought I would just mention some of the remarks that he makes about this painting, which is also included in the English edition of the Television text, a painting by Caravaggio, The Sacrifice of Isaac, because that painting in Lacan's discussion seems to concern 2 different relations to the big other. It seems to be a moment in a narrative before which Abraham has a particular relation to the big other, and after which, as Caravaggio's painting shows, God sends down an angel to stop the hand of Abraham and to keep him from cutting the throat of his son. And Lacan, I take it, interprets this as a kind of interdiction which says, God does not want you to try to satisfy his jouissance. What God wants from you is some kind of devotion, some kind of love. He wants to know that your desire is directed toward him, but he doesn't want you to satisfy his jouissance. And so that would mean then that the initial impetus of Abraham, hearing the voice of God, and there's a lot about the voice in Television, hearing the voice of God, commanding him, telling him what to do, because he loves God, will do anything to satisfy this big other who now is figured as an omnipotent, devouring other whose jouissance knows no limit, and in the face of which Abraham is prepared to do anything. But then once he gets up on the mountain with his son, just before he makes the incision, God sends down the angel, and there's a wonderful kind of play of hands to stop the hand of Abraham, and with his other hand, the angel you see in the Caravaggio painting points with his finger at the ram as a kind of sacrificial substitute. And after that moment, we can say there's a kind of transformation in the status of the big other. We can say that in the first case, the big other is unlimited. We could say unmarked by lack. The big other is absolute, devouring, will consume every possible object. And Abraham, as a subject in relation to this big other, is prepared to give up everything in order to satisfy the jouissance of the big other. Whereas after this suspension, this moment of suspension, now, in effect, there is a place of lack marked within the big other. And now God has said, in effect, this is not your business. It's not your business to try to know what object will complete me, what object will fill up my make me complete as a big other. So now, after this moment of suspension of the sacrifice, the big other is lacking. And I was thinking about that relationship, which Lacan goes on to develop in terms of the difference between jouissance and desire, really, because in the first case, the big other is the big other of jouissance. In the second case, the big other is lacking, that is to say, desiring. Once has a relationship of desire to Abraham, but not the sacrificial economy that is in the first relation to the big other. And Abraham's own desire would seem to depend on passing from one position to the other, that is, from giving up in a certain way the relation to the first big other, the big other of jouissance, and passing somehow to a position where he can have a relation to the big other insofar as the big other desires and is lacking. And this discussion of this painting is something that I've been thinking about a lot, which you have just in the last few pages. If you haven't noticed the image, it's just here on the last page. And Lacan gives this as the single seminar, the single aborted seminar in 1961 of his last seminar at the Sainte Anne Hospital, after which he was excluded from the training and had to go into the university precisely to continue his teaching. And so there was only one session of this seminar. It was a seminar called with a pluralization of the father, les noms du père, with a plural, the names of the father. And what Lacan goes on to develop in that seminar, which came the year after his seminar on anxiety, is a peculiar point that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that he says, in order to pass from jouissance to desire, Abraham has to go through the gateway of anxiety. That anxiety is the threshold that one has to cross to get from jouissance to desire. It's like the path that one has to cross. And just as one little indication of that, I hope it's in the text that you've got, maybe not. It's just the page before. If anyone's brought the English with them, I think it's on page 89. He says, yeah, just a couple of passages here that prepare that painting, three paragraphs in the bottom of page 89. He says, it is here that the accent I allowed to be put on the function of perversion. You may remember the references he makes to perversion just in the passage I quoted from television. It is here that the accent I allowed to be put on the function of perversion in its relation to the desire of the other as such takes on value, to wit, that it represents a backing up against the wall, a strictly literal interpretation of the function of the Father, of the Supreme Being, of eternal God. He is taken in a strictly literal interpretation of the letter, not of his bliss, that is to say, jouissance, right? Not of his bliss, which is always veiled and inscrutable, but of his desire, as interested in the order of the world. And that is the principle through which the pervert, molding his own anxiety, installs himself as such. And then the other sentence is the one on the knife. Remember this? Let me just see if I can find one sentence. Yeah, it's page 94. You do have this one. In the last long paragraph on the page, about 15 lines from the bottom of the page. He says, here may be marked the knife blade, I take it he's talking about the knife that Abraham holds, separating God's bliss from what in that tradition is presented as his desire.
God's results, in fact.
Yeah. And so, just as a kind of opening for the discussion, I thought I would mention this as maybe some way of trying to get at what Catherine was talking about in terms of the strange division in the rite between the kind of extreme, frightening, bomb Hanoi, bomb Hanoi, and the images of Giscard d'Estaing, who seems to be ordinary, normal guy in the social
order. I would say modern rather than primordial, because what the students had responded to in 68 was this sort of primordial immovability of de Gaulle, you know, as the father of all fathers, not modern, of another order. Yeah. And I guess one of the other things that I wanted to talk to that I wanted to say was that the left splinters, the right splits. Psychoanalysis splinters and fragments. It keeps splintering, Lacanianism especially, but also Freudianism as well. And the right is able to maintain this beautiful sort of dyadic relationship, symbiotic relationship between these two faces now. And the left is radically splintered. These are things that I wanted to talk about. I also thought that what you were saying, Charlie, had something to do with the discourse of the soldiers around Abu Ghraib. We were told that we had to soften them up. We didn't know what this meant. So this is what we... this is how far we were going to go. So we came up with this because we were responding to this demand from their superiors. And the fact that it would take the form of sexual humiliation then moves, of course, into the register of fantasy. That there was a permissiveness that came from above. You know, as Zizek calls, you know, the joui, the obscene imperative to enjoy. And this happened. And I think that the strongest ethical lessons of psychoanalysis is that, you know, that this is a possibility between human beings. That the injunction to love one neighbor as oneself, for it says in Civilization and Discontent, is so impossible to fulfill that it becomes derisory in Christianity. Because what's actually possible, radically possible, in relationship to one's neighbor is that one uses him or her as an object, if one can do so with impunity. And so what the soldiers were released into was the radicality of fantasy. So we'll stop there and then take questions, I guess.
Questions?
Yes,
at that time, the debate was more between Derrida and the Derridians and Lacan and the Lacanians as to the importance of technology, but not seen, as McLuhan has tried to show, as a sort of wiping out the old types of writing, but more as a fundamental disagreement as to the role of the voice, or let's say the definition of the signifier as being vocal or not, or as something that would be closer to writing, therefore technology, some kind of technology, inscription, dead letters, and so on. Yes, I see.
I wondered if either of you had a comment about the sort of tagline at the end, I think, of the first clip about laughter. Tend to be very cryptic about the status of his discourse in connection with capitalism and the identity of Blackburn. I particularly have a comment about it, right? Seems something going on there. And then the students are saying, oh, you're this clown. You're this clown. So, what's going on here?
Well, I think it's a good question about the way Lacan was seen as a sort of clown as well, and maybe too much has been made of that. You know, the Zen master version of Lacan.
But I would say also this is part of the way in which I think he thinks about, or he talks back to Marxisms, or discourses of Marxisms, because there's no... I would say that it's a release in any in some way of Bakhtinian laughter. You know, not that capitalism is going to be deposed and there will be this utopia. It's an anti-utopian laughter. But if you have more saints, you have more clowns, you have more laughter, capitalism will not end, but and there will be no, you know, program for tomorrow.
Yeah, it's anti-utopian in the sense that comedy is often the term that Lacan uses to mark the position that one has if one really understands that there is no such thing as a sexual relation. So right, it's precisely why you have comedy. Comedy as a genre, as opposed to tragedy, is there because it's always comedy around sexual confusion, right? Like Midsummer Night's Dream and so on, people mixing each other up, and that's the truth. And we laugh. And so it's anti-utopian in the sense that we laugh when we understand that the complete, final, teleological ending in which everyone finds their proper place and the relations are all equalized and so on, that's not going to happen. And it's precisely what he says in the sentence you mentioned. He says, the more saints, that is to say, analysts, right, the more laughter. That's my principle, to wit, the way out of capitalist discourse. So I think comedy is connected to the lack of a sexual relation, which capitalism doesn't, which the discourse of Marxism doesn't take account of sufficiently.
But maybe just to add one little thing, it seems that at least the way I hear this now is that when we talk about laughter for Lacan, there is Bataille's laughter somewhere behind. Mm. And so, as you may know, Lacan and Bataille had been close enough, and in 68 precisely, there was a return to the Bataillean moment of la fête, you know, the absolute orgy, the party, laughter breaking all the structures of the old world and so on, which was considered as neo-anarchist versus a certain Stalinian Marxism that insisted on seriousness. And so laughter was on the side of
anarchism,
the post-surrealism, and all these uncontrollable elements, whereas the dominant Marxist discourse then was a discourse of, you know, comrade, you have to be serious, work with the masses, and so on. So Lacan was at that cusp, I think.
But it would have to be a laughter, the Bataillean version would have to be a laughter of la fête and orgiastic, perhaps, but not in the way that the students are saying, if we can have free love, everybody will be happy.
That's it. And this is where Lacan, in a way, redoubles and complicates Bataille's discourse facing Marxism. As you may know, he was trying to work something like the economy of waste in capitalism, and Lacan says, well, no, not only that, you have to work an economy of jouissance, where you have Mehrwert in German, so surplus value, you can also have surplus enjoyment, Mehrlust, as he coins the word. Mehrlust doesn't exist in Marx, but...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, because the objection of Clashes, you want to know what it was, you need to read. I think you took one. Did you know this book? When you read this, you see why you actually generated this. Because actually, the seminar was really, it kind of, a lot of people were generating into bonds and games and things like that. And a lot of that began to look quite sort of, you know, ineffective. You find that also interesting for me. But trying to go back a little bit to the politics of Lacan, which I really must say I'm not entirely clear about myself at all. What maybe not coming out, not coming clear from what I'm saying here, is by about 1971, it's true. I'm sure that actually Lacan regarded as a whole.
It was what?
It was regarding as a whole, as it is called, it was. Second, right with listeners. And that was, I think, because of the, I think the two conservative attacks that were made against it. One is by Deleuze, Catharine, and also by Foucault, actually. And I would also add the fact that you know, many still have their master's degrees about the series or reading this. That I think should be clear. I never really, I mean, I do think that why, for example, you know, a lot of particularly literary criticism, Lacan was definitely a figure. I mean, if you read Delcay, many of the articles that were there certainly suggest that this was still a kind of metaphysical.
But you know, I'm not sure that that's so clear, because I think that at that time is when he makes his biggest alliance with Jacques Alain Miller, who is on the far left. And so if he's seen as a right winger by Deleuze and Guattari and Foucault, he's actually getting in bed with the far left. And he's getting in bed with the far left Maoists who are anti-bureaucratic, and that fits very well in with the power struggles he's going to launch in his own school and against the IPA. But the other thing is that I think that the left has, you know, this is part of the fragmentation of the left that I was talking about, is that there are so many different lefts, and one form of the far left that a more moderate form of the left might say degenerated or was seen as degenerating into anarchy and anarchism. And Lacan had this kind of anarcho, you know, he had an anarcho politics towards it that was very close to the politics of the early situationists, too, to, you know, not make sense, the détournement of language, the unintelligibility that he worked with. I mean, I wouldn't say it was self-consciously a quoting of Debord, but there was, but the left thought of the situationists, or the more mainstream left, also thought of the situationists as being so anarchist that they were actually on the right. And I think that that's part of the confusion of the times. And I also think that that's part of a question of a posture that he took that was very enigmatic at this point, to, you know, ally himself so closely with the Maoists, who today, I mean, Badiou and Miller's militancy are still based upon, I think, one version of Lacanianism. You know, Badiou can't stop using Lacanian terms. His militancy is all couched in Lacanian terms, and he sees himself still as a Maoist. I mean, recently, I think on the web in Culture Machine, he wrote that he thought that the condemnation of the Chinese Cultural Revolution was purely bourgeois. Because when there's a real struggle against technocracy, people have to die. And it's a very extreme position, but I think that it's couched in a, you know, in a kind of Lacano-Arnicism, if you like.
I agree. I would slightly disagree. I don't think that, at least as he was perceived in 71, 72, even though there were important disagreements, and I think 72 is the moment when feminism is really emerging and posing difficult questions to Lacan and also deconstruction, but he was not seen as on the right. He was seen as a Maoist, and, well, you could say Maoism is a sort of right-wing thing, but that would be twisting. No, he was seen as a sort of President Mao within psychoanalysis, trying to recreate his own discourse and launching the Young Guards with the little, not red, but white book of Écrit, against the establishment of psychoanalysis. Just as, and that was the myth, the Chinese Revolution, Cultural Revolution, was seen as getting rid of the old world and getting rid of whatever remained of Confucianism and so on.
And technocracy. Badiou says, no compromise with technocrats. No compromise with bureaucrats.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think Badiou is a good example of somebody who's remained a Lacanian now, and who's never really abandoned his Maoism. I mean, Badiou is another case. Maybe we shouldn't, you know, somehow make him completely identical with Lacan, but I think he's one of the most visible French disciples of Lacan.
I mean, would you think that, could you then address the Deleuze Foucault? I mean, because the answer to Deleuze, I mean, psychoanalysis as a whole, particularly the same with Lacan, essentially,
I don't think so. That's it. That's what I disagree slightly, and this is what I realized, and we saw this in a conference last year with philosophers like Greg Lambert, who are Deleuzians, that today it looks like the clash between Deleuze and the Deleuzians and Lacan and the Lacanians is less important than the convergence. That in fact, if you read Anti-Oedipus, Deleuze praises Lacan for certain things, like having reintroduced desire, the mother as big other, and so on. What he attacks is Freud. And so Lacan is seen, and I'm not sure whether this is absolutely true, but Lacan is seen as going in the right direction, but not far enough because he's too close to Freud.
And you know, I think that what Deleuze and Guattari were responding to was psychiatry and the institutionalization of psychoanalysis around André Green. And for better or worse, Lacan introduces the term desire into psychoanalysis. Freud never wrote about desire as we can translate it into English. Lust and Wunsch, these are not words of desire. The Gallicization of psychoanalysis takes place through Deleuze and Lacan in terms of this term desire. And so that's, I think it's a false polemics that takes place between, you know what it is? The Deleuzians and Lacanians in America hate each other. But that's something very different from what 1972 was in France. It's inexorable. You get into a room with Deleuzians now and there's no space. It's irremediable.
It's the same with Foucault. You read Foucault, then you're not allowed to read Lacan. If you read Lacan, you hate Foucault. There's no question. You have to sign on the contract somewhere.
Right.
But, you know, that's an American peculiarity, I think, because Foucault was still taking...
I think we should take another question, because we're going to get caught up. But it's
no, it's true. They presented it to him at the seminar, sure.
Actually, it's the only thing the American actually out of that there's the whole world coming together. On the country.
But I think in Foucault's case, it's true that his target was always, from the early work on madness to the later work on the history of sexuality, his target was always the institutionalization of psychiatry, of the category of mental illness. And to that extent, maybe he would have questions about the diagnostic categories that may still attach even to psychoanalytic discourse, but it doesn't mean that he was anti-Lacanian, I don't think, because he was still writing about Las Meninas out of Lacan's seminar and so on.
I mean, okay, in 69, when Foucault presented on what is an author, mm-hmm. invited Lacan mm-hmm. to contribute, he spoke, when Foucault presented, you know, founders of the discursivity and those who mm-hmm. obliged to a constant rereading. Lacan said, yes, this is me, this is what I'm doing. So I think at that time, there was no clash at all between Foucault and Lacan. There were divergences here and there, but of course, Foucault was more later on visible politically active with prisoners and so on. Lacan was caught up in the complex issues of his own school and the dissolution and so on, but I don't think there was any real rift. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes?
Go back to the modern man on the right. You talked about the modern man on the right, mm-hmm. you talked about the old one that has this one voice that comes in the ball, and there's this one voice that speaks and everybody follows. The modern man on the right, I would think that there would be less of a right, term, because people have more chance to speak their opinions, and yet there is still, in America, thinking about the United States, there still is one voice that was very, very much in the right. And I'm thinking in your essay that you wrote with Lacan and Warhol, you were talking about the power of radio and media, and is that, it's not, does this give this modern right wing its force, and what would be to counter that, what kind of where is that going?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, but, you know, the real master of radio and politics was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was man of the left. And what evolves, I think, is that the right catches up. It takes a long time for them to catch up, but they do catch up. And no one could match FDR's eloquence on the radio. He was the politician who mastered that medium. At the same time that Delano wrote that he mastered the medium, for the left, though, there was already the far right-wing radio broadcast, what we think of today as evangelists, were vying for time. But they couldn't appeal to the emotional core of America during the Great Depression because Roosevelt was already doing that. And the right wing was very apocalyptic and all this other stuff on the radio. And I think that there's these certain very mediatic personalities. And what I think that Giscard d'Estaing did was he understood the medium and he understood public relations. Pompidou and De Gaulle did not. So when Jean-Michel says that in 1971, France was not a very mediatized culture. You know, part of what lagged behind was this traditional rural right-wing France. And D'Estaing brought that sense of that Catholic right-wing sensibility into some, embodied it, not as a voice, as a face. What I'm going to say. It was a face. Smiling, young, active. Right. Yes, if you like. And that mobilization in France is very important because he was able to take advantage of a power vacuum on the right and bring the right wing back into power in the 70s, actually. So it's a very complicated question, but I suppose, you know, there's nothing about radio or television that says that it's a medium of the left or right, is what I'm saying. That in the history of modernity and broadcast media, there are certain people who understand how to use it. Now, Lacan's use of it is interesting because, in a certain sense, he magnifies or amplifies the representational quality of the medium by being so theatrical. But he was theatrical throughout his performance as an analyst, and this was held against him. But in a certain sense, he allowed constantly for himself to be wired in a way that was seen as being very unfortunate for analysts, because analysts notoriously, after the IPA, were reticent about publicness. So that was held against him, by the Freudians, the Orthodox Freudians.
But since you talked earlier on about hysteria, let's not forget that Charcot invented, in a way, this kind of scene before radio really existed, where you would have an object that would be the hysterics, the captive audience of the assistants, the doctors, and so on, the interns around Charcot, and then behind the high society that would come in mass, really, to these presentations in which Charcot would improvise brilliantly each time. And I think Lacan follows in those steps. Mm. And indeed, what you pointed out, and that very few people have shown, that Lacan, without the tape recorder, would not have been Lacan somehow, that his mode of delivery was so oracular, enigmatic, provoking, and ambiguous, fundamentally. You were never sure of having really heard what he had said, that you needed something like the tape recorder, or later on, indeed, radio, television, all these technical machines we had.
One minute.
Happily, when Mr. Mann is still burning. He's not completely dead. transmission. On the one hand, you bring the political dimension of psychoanalysis, and the psychoanalyst only being breaking the traditional orthodoxy of the practice, attacking the orthodoxy, and also speaking up. Maybe no longer as an analyst, although he claims in the text that he's reproducing the same analytic situation that he would have in the seminar. And I was also very curious about your choice for tonight, presenting a fragment of Television, then the Cleats, and also a text from the Names of the Father. So I wanted to hear more, and I was wondering if you had any logical linking of this text, and I wanted to hear more about that.
Well, I guess just to follow the last little thread, it strikes me that when Jean-Michel mentions Charcot, there were all those references in the Lacan material that we read about suggestibility and transference and the way in which there can be an effect produced in an audience without them understanding. And maybe that's in a way a requirement. The sound breaks down, you can't quite hear what he's saying, or he says something that is unintelligible in a way or ambiguous, and that produces effects that go outside what can be sort of logically formulated. Not that Lacan doesn't have his own precision. People who say Lacan is playing word games, I think that's a huge mistake, because he's very rigorous in his analytical work. But there is also this dimension of in a way, a kind of transferential bond, which then gets played out in politics. And we were saying on the way up in the car that the left is now in the position of being frustrated because they have all their charts and their graphs and their statistics, and they can show people are unemployed, you know, the deficit is bad, you know, all the facts are on our side, and yet we're powerless, we're helpless, we're melancholic.
Well, I disagree with that characterization of the left being melancholic right now. I think the left is actually not melancholic any longer. Maybe was, but...
This is very recent. This is very recent. So, and as you say, it can shift sides very easily. So the media are not necessarily a vehicle of the left or the right. But the point is that maybe there's some way in which, you know, there's something about... there's something that psychoanalysis does that's really manifested in the performance of the television text that deals with this affective dimension, and that's what I was interested in the Caravaggio painting, is that what we're dealing with is really a transformation of something that Lacan also talks about in terms of the body and the experience of the body in television, the existence of the body, that it carries its jouissance or its desire, it handles anxiety, and is able to transform anxiety into something productive or into something petrifying, depending on mechanisms that psychoanalysis can describe, but that arguments themselves, philosophical discourse won't be able to describe. So that was what I saw as the linkage between all of them.
Well, I'm going to do a very like crude Žižekian thing and say that if we think the allegory of the painting where Abraham is about to sacrifice Isaac and you have the angel holding back his hand, you could say that Abraham was the soldier of Abu Ghraib trying to satisfy his superiors and thinking, maybe I'll just have to kill him, and then the angel is actually the analyst. And passing from the father willing to sacrifice his son to the one who refrains, you know, has to take place through analysis. And when you get to the other side, your relationship to the big other is one of transference rather than one of like perverse perversion, where you say, you know, I just want to satisfy this, you know, how can I enjoy more, how can I make, you know, what does he want of me, you know, I'll strip him, I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but okay, I'll poop on him, I'll, you know, whatever it is, what extremity to which I can go. And so the angel becomes that, you know, the hand that moves it back. But, you know, a strained allegory, if we could say, of that might be then what we could prescribe for the soldiers is psychoanalysis.
Maybe just to go back again to this example, let's not forget that for Kierkegaard, in his long commentaries on this scene, one of the paradoxes is that Abraham is silent. He's the man of religion, the man of ethics, but he's silent. He doesn't say what he's going to do. And so psychoanalysis he's trying to reintroduce some discourse where he's silent here by allegorizing all the elements and so on, like the Talmud. Lacan is really looking back to Rashi in his as a model somehow. And I think the Talmudic dimension in Lacan is very, very strong. Mm-hmm. Like, it should go on talking because we need to put words where there is this mute, decision to follow the law or maybe to enjoy.
There's a piece of our meeting in which the Father God is sending the angel to stop the man with his son, and he asks for this world's war to be destroyed. In other words, you can kill your first war, you can kill yourself, and it's almost suicidal too, to some extent. So what he's forgetting to do is the fact that God shows the world like I never did from the last time I was saying as a big around these people. So there's a little of Father misericordia, forgiving, and asking for somebody to do something only to make sure that they can do it, but they didn't have precisely to do it. So that one somehow is missing in the discourse. And I like it when there's this passage.
Do you understand?
Yeah, there's something about the merciful Father, the merciful God who restrains this. Who restrains the hand, who asks for the sacrifice only to restrain the hand.
But what Rashi pointed out was that Abraham was a little disappointed and said, what, not even a little cut, just to have his blood flow as a sign of alliance. And I think this is the other moment of when you start cutting, where do you stop?
It's a solution to anxiety in a way, the desire to make the cut, even once the suspension has been made, that Abraham is full of anxiety because he now no longer knows.
Right.
Right? It's certainty that's been disrupted. He no longer knows what it is that the big other wants of him. And so, and that's that fills one with anxiety.
Abraham knows what he loves. He loves to be in God and trust him. Therefore, he has to do under God. I don't think that his greediness,
that Lacan showed his political manipulations, I don't think that Lacan shows that, not God. But there's a level in which one has also said, thank you, God, for allowing my first born into you. Mm. You know, one thing I was going to say is that I actually, this is one place where I think I'm much closer to Freud than Lacan here, because I don't like the religiosity of the allegory around transference. So even though I painted that, I want to erase it completely, because I think that Freud was much more radical in wanting to expunge not only to expose the structures of religious belief, but to expunge even the image itself. You know, and in that sense, I think that Freud's iconophobia is a more radical form of secularism than this extraordinary care with which Lacan, you know, reads the paintings. Not only this one, but Holbein, too. You know, Freud was so, he hated music. I mean, the guy couldn't stand listening to music because I could say he was so sublimated, in a good sense, but also, you know, secular in his Judaism, in his relationship to the image. So there's something so sensual and sort of over the top about that Caravaggio image, and I think it would be something that Freud would never have wanted to look at, actually, very much. You know, he picked the most... Well, that's what I'm saying, and I kind of feel...
But without this Jesuit Baroque element, he would probably not have really been able to talk well about jouissance and perversion, with an extreme complicity at times, perversion, but still. Any other questions? Well, I think it's time to
call it. And thank you very much for your patience.